What was prohibited was to emit bills of credit, which, according to the speeches and writings of those who drafted the document, meant the printing of paper IOUs, which were intended to be circulated as money. In other words, the printing of fiat money, not backed by gold or silver. At first, it would seem that nothing could be more clear. Yet these two simple clauses have become the basis for literally thousands of pages of conflicting interpretation. The crux of the problem is that while the Constitution clearly prohibits the states from issuing fiat money, it does not specifically prevent the federal government from doing so. That was truly an unfortunate oversight on the part of the document's framers, but they probably never dreamed in their wildest nightmares that their descendants could be so stupid as to not understand their intent. Furthermore, it ain't easy to miss their intent. All one has to do is look at the monetary history that led up to the Constitutional Convention and to read the published letters and debates of the men who affixed their signatures to that founding document. As one reads through the debates on the floor of the convention, one is struck by the passion that these delegates held on the subject of money. Every one of them could remember from his personal experience the utter chaos in the colonies caused by the issuance of fiat money. They spoke out against it in no uncertain terms, and they were adamant that it should never be tolerated again in America, at either the state or federal level. Paper money in the colonies. The first colonial experience with fiat money was in the period from 1690 to 1764. Massachusetts was the first to use it as a means of financing its military raids against the French colony in Quebec. The other colonies were quick to follow suit and, within a few years, were engaging in a virtual orgy of printing bills of credit. There was no central bank involved. The process was simple and direct, as was the reasoning behind it. As one colonial legislator explained it, "Do you think, gentlemen, that I will consent to load my constituents with taxes when we can send to our printer and get a wagon load of money, one quire of which will pay for the whole?" The consequences of this enlightened statesmanship were classic. Prices skyrocketed, legal tender laws were enacted to force the colonists to accept the worthless paper, and the common man endured great personal losses and hardship. By the late 1750s, Connecticut had prices inflated by 800%. The Carolinas had inflated 900%. Massachusetts, 1,000%. Rhode Island, 2,300%. The situation was so out of hand that, beginning in 1751, the British Parliament stepped in, and in one of those rare instances where interference from the mother country actually benefited the colonies, it forced them to cease the production of fiat money. Henceforth, the Bank of England would be the only source. What followed was unforeseen by the promoters of fiat money. Amid great gloom about insufficient money, a miracle boom of prosperity occurred. The forced use of fiat money had compelled everyone to hoard their real money and use the worthless paper instead. Now that the paper was in disgrace, the colonists began to use their English and French and Dutch gold coins once again. Prices rapidly adjusted to reality, and commerce returned to a solid footing. It remained so even during the economic strain of the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, and during the period immediately prior to the Revolution. Here was a perfect example of how an economic system in distress can recover if government does not interfere with the healing process. Wartime inflation. But all of this came to a halt with the onset of colonial rebellion. Not only did open hostilities throw England deeper into the cogs and wheels of the central bank mechanism, it also was the compelling motive for the colonies to return to their printing presses. The following figures speak eloquently for themselves. At the beginning of the war in 1775, the total money supply for the Federated Colonies stood at $12 million. In June of that year, the Continental Congress issued another $2 million, Before the notes were printed, another $1 million was authorized. By the end of the year, another $3 million. $19 million in 1776, $13 million in 1777, $64 million in 1778, $125 million in 1779. A total of $227 million in 5 years, on top of a base of $12 million, is an increase of about 2,000%. On top of this federal money, the states were doing the same in an approximately equal amount. And still more, the Continental Army, unable to get enough money from Congress, issued certificates for the purchase of supplies totaling $200 million. $650 million created in 5 years on top of a base of $12 million is an expansion of the money supply of over 5,000%. Although the economy was devastated by this flood of fiat money, most victims were totally unaware of the cause. In 1777, the sentiment of a large segment of the population was expressed by the words of one patriotic old lady who said, "What a shame it is that Congress should let the poor soldiers suffer when they have power to make just as much money as they choose." The immediate result of this money infusion was the appearance of prosperity. After all, everyone had more money, and that was perceived as a very good thing. But this was quickly followed by inflation as the self-destruct mechanism began to roll. In 1775, the colonial monetary unit, called the Continental, was valued at $1 in gold. In 1778, it was exchanged for 25 cents. By 1779, just 4 years from its issue, it was worth less than a penny and ceased to circulate as money at all. It was in that year that George Washington wrote, "A wagon load of money will scarcely purchase a wagon load of provisions." The saying, "not worth a continental," has its origin in this gloomy period. The true nature of the inflation effect has never been more accurately perceived or more vividly described than it was by Thomas Jefferson. It will be asked, how will the two masses of continental and of state money have cost the people of the United States 72 millions of dollars when they are to be redeemed now with about 6 million? I answer that the difference, being 66 millions, has been lost on the paper bills separately by the successive holders of them. Every one through whose hands a bill passed lost on that bill what it lost in value during the time it was in his hands. This was a real tax on him, and in this way the people of the United States actually contributed those 66 millions of dollars during the war, and by a mode of taxation the most oppressive of all, because the most unequal of all. Price controls and legal tender laws. It was natural that people struggled to find ways to escape the destruction of their savings, and the two most obvious methods were, one, to regularly adjust prices upward as the value of the money went downward, or, two, exchange their goods and services only for gold coins. In response, the colonial legislatures and the Continental Congress did what governments always do to prevent it. They resorted to wage and price controls and to legal tender laws with harsh penalties for non-compliance. Under one such law, those who refused to accept worthless money were even described as traitors. It declared, "If any person shall hereafter be so lost to all virtue and regard for his country as to refuse to accept its notes, such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country." Rhode Island not only levied a substantial fine for non-acceptance of its notes, but upon a second offense, an individual lost his citizenship. When this was declared unlawful by a panel of judges, the legislature reacted by dismissing the judges from office. Then, as now, those who suffered the most from fiat money were those who held the most trust in government. In 1777, these were mostly the Whigs, for it was they who patriotically held paper money, and as a result lost their livelihoods and their life savings. The Tories, on the other hand, mistrusting both government and its paper money, passed the bills as quickly as possible in trade for real assets, especially gold. Consequently, as a group, they weathered the storm fairly well. But they often were derided by their less prudent neighbors as Tory speculators, hoarders, and even traitors. All this was painfully fresh in the memories of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, and as the opening session convened in Philadelphia in 1787, there were angry mobs in the streets threatening the legislators. Looting was rampant. Businesses were bankrupt. Drunkenness and lawlessness were everywhere to be seen. The fruit of fiat money had ripened, and the delegates did not enjoy its taste. In October of 1785, George Washington wrote, "The wheels of government are clogged, and we are descending into the veil of confusion and darkness." A year later, in a letter to James Madison, he said, "No day was ever more clouded than the present. We are fast verging to anarchy." In February of 1787, Washington wrote to Henry Knox, "If any person had told me that there would have been such formidable rebellion as exists, I would have thought him fit for a madhouse." Just 3 months prior to the opening of the convention, Washington voiced his reasons for rejecting the notion of fiat money. In answer to the complaint that there was not enough gold coin, specie, to satisfy the needs of commerce, he replied, "The necessity arising from a want of specie is represented as greater than it really is. I contend that it is by the substance, not by the shadow of a thing, we are to be benefited. The wisdom of man, in my humble opinion, cannot at this time devise a plan by which the credit of paper money would be long supported. Consequently, depreciation keeps pace with the quantity of the emission, and articles for which it is exchanged rise in a greater ratio than the sinking value of the money. Wherein, then, is the farmer, the planter, the artisan benefited? An evil equally great is the door it immediately opens for speculation, by which the least designing and perhaps most valuable part of the community are preyed upon by the more knowing and crafty speculators."
You have reached the end of Disc 11.
The Constitutional Convention. This was the prevailing view held by the great majority of delegates to the convention. They were adamant in their resolve to create a constitution which would prevent any state, and especially the federal government itself, from ever again issuing fiat money. And they said so in unmistakable terms. Oliver Ellsworth from Connecticut, who later was to become our third Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said, "This is a favorable moment to shut and bar the door against paper money. The mischief of the various experiments which have been made are now fresh in the public mind and have excited the disgust of all the respectable parts of America." George Mason from Virginia told the delegates he had a moral hatred to paper money. Previously, he had written to George Washington, "They may pass a law to issue paper money, but 20 laws will not make the people receive it. Paper money is founded upon fraud and knavery." James Wilson from Pennsylvania said, "It will have the most salutary influence on the credit of the United States to remove the possibility of paper money." John Langdon from New Hampshire warned that he would rather reject the whole plan of federation than to grant the new government the right to issue fiat money. George Reed from Delaware declared that a provision in the Constitution granting the new government the right to issue fiat money would be as alarming as the mark of the beast in Revelation. Thomas Paine, although not a delegate to the convention, had written the previous year that he was strongly opposed to fiat money, which he called counterfeiting by the state, and he especially abhorred legal tender laws which force people to accept the counterfeit. He said, "The punishment of a member of a legislature who should move for such a law ought to be death." An interesting thought. If any further evidence is needed that the Founding Fathers intended to prohibit the federal government from issuing bills of credit, consider this. The first draft of the Constitution was copied in large measure from the original Articles of Confederation. When it was taken up for consideration by the delegates, therefore, it contained the old provision that had caused so much chaos. It stated, "The legislature of the United States shall have the power to borrow money and emit bills of credit." But after a lively discussion on the matter, the offending provision was voted to be removed from the Constitution by an overwhelming margin. Voicing the sentiment of the majority of the delegates, Alexander Hamilton said, "To emit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor ever hereafter to be employed, being in its nature repugnant with abuses and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud." The journal of the convention for August 16th contains this notation. "It was moved and seconded to strike out the words, and emit bills of credit, and the motion passed in the affirmative." The vote cleared by a margin of better than 4-1. The 10th Amendment states, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The power to issue bills of credit is definitely not delegated to the United States, and it is specifically prohibited to the states. Therefore, if any power to issue fiat money legally exists at all, it is reserved for the people. In other words, individuals and private institutions, such as banks, have the right to issue IOUs and hope that the public will use them as money, but government at any level is clearly prohibited by the Constitution from doing so." A suggestion for your congressman. Incidentally, the Constitution has never been amended on this point, nor has the provision that only silver and gold can be used as lawful money. It would be interesting if each reader of this book would send copies to his or her elected representatives in Washington, or at least a photocopy of this section. Every member of Congress has sworn to uphold the Constitution, and you might attach a short note asking them when they intend to begin. Do not be disappointed if your reply is less than satisfactory. Politicians have a similar problem to that which judges have. It is permissible to rock the boat from time to time, but they are not supposed to sink it. Suits against the government challenging the constitutionality of our monetary system seldom get to court. It is safer for the justices to decline to accept these cases or to dismiss them as supposedly frivolous. Otherwise, they would face a difficult choice. Either they would have to mutilate logic in order to uphold the present inconsistencies, thus opening themselves to possible ridicule, or they would have to declare in favor of the Constitution and literally cause the collapse of the entire deficit spending central bank mechanism. Such an act would take a considerable amount of courage. Not only would they suffer the wrath of the establishment that is nourished by that mechanism, they also would have to face a bewildered public which, because of lack of knowledge about the Constitution or the nature of money, could easily be convinced that the judges had lost their minds. Likewise, it is safer for politicians to respond to inquiries of this kind merely by quoting some self-serving government document which makes our fiat monetary system sound quite legal and marvelously constitutional. Unfortunately, that is reality. Until the public becomes considerably better informed than it is at present, we cannot expect too much from the courts or from Congress. Bringing this matter to the attention of your elected representatives, however, is still well worth the effort, because the process of education has to start somewhere, and Washington is an excellent place to begin. Returning to the point of this digression, however, it is important to know that the federal government was given a precisely limited monetary function: to coin money and to regulate the value thereof. In view of the fact that gold and silver coin was specifically defined as the only kind of money to be allowed, There can be no doubt of what was meant by the first half of that power. To coin money meant to mint precious metal coins. Period. The second half is equally clear. Both in the Constitution and in the discussions among the delegates, the power to regulate the value of gold and silver coin was closely tied to the power to determine weights and measures. They are, in fact, one and the same. To regulate the value of coin is exactly the same as to set the nationally accepted value of a mile, or a pound, or a quart. It is to create a standard against which a thing may be measured. The wording of this section of the Constitution can be traced to the original Articles of Confederation, which further clarifies the meaning that was generally understood at that time. The United States in Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of coin struck by their own authority, or by that of the respective states, fixing the standard of weights and measures throughout the United States. The intent, therefore, was simply for Congress to determine the exact weight of a precious metal that would constitute the national monetary unit. The origin of the dollar. At the time of these deliberations, Spanish silver coins, called pieces of eight, had already become the de facto monetary unit. An official commission had been established by the Continental Congress to sample the circulating coins in the country and determine their average value by weight and purity. Charts were published, and all coins of various origin were listed by comparative value. Congress was already regulating the value of the nation's money by the time the Constitution was drafted. How these coins became dollars is an interesting story. Edwin Vieira tells us, "Monetary historians generally first associate the dollar with one Count Schlick, who began striking such silver coins in 1519 in Joachimsthal, Bavaria. Then known as Schlichtenthalers, or Joachimsthalers, the coins became known simply as thalers, which transliterated into dollars." Interestingly, the American colonies did not adopt the dollar from England, but from Spain. Under that country's monetary reform of 1497, the silver real became the Spanish money unit, or unit of account. A new coin consisting of 8 reales also appeared, variously known as pesos, duros, piezos de ocho, pieces of 8, or Spanish dollars, because of their similarity in weight and fineness to the thaler. The coins quickly achieved predominance in financial markets of the New World because of Spain's then important commercial and political position. In 1785, Thomas Jefferson urged the adoption of the Spanish silver dollar as the nation's official monetary unit. In a pamphlet submitted to the delegates of the Continental Congress, he said, "Taking into our view all money transactions, great and small, I question if a common measure of more convenient size than the dollar could be proposed. The unit or dollar is a known coin, and the most familiar of all to the minds of people. It is already adopted from south to north, has identified our currency, and therefore happily offers itself as an unit already introduced." On July 6, 1785, Congress unanimously voted to adopt the Spanish dollar as the official monetary unit of the United States. Jefferson realized, however, that this was not sufficient. Although the coin had been one of the most dependable in terms of weight and quality, it still varied in content between issues, and a way had to be found to rate one coin in value against another. That was, after all, the service that Congress was required to render when it was given the power to regulate the value of money. Jefferson came directly to the point when he said, "If we determine that a dollar shall be our unit, we must then say with precision what a dollar is. This coin, as struck at different times, of different weight and fineness, is of different values." The logic voiced by Jefferson could not be ignored. 2 years later, after carefully examining the actual weight and fineness of the Spanish dollars currently in circulation, Congress defined the dollar. After ratification of the Constitution, a dollar would contain 371.25 grains of fine silver, and all items in commerce, including other coins, were to be measured in value against that standard. As the Spaniards continued to reduce the silver content of their coins, the pressure for the minting of an American dollar of predictable value began to mount. Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton, in his 1791 report to Congress, urged the establishment of a federal mint and also presented a powerful case for maintaining an inviolable standard for the coins to be produced by that mint. He said, "The dollar originally contemplated in the money transactions of this country, by successive diminutions of its weight and fineness, has sustained a depreciation of 5%, and yet the new dollar has a currency in all payments in place of the old, with scarcely any attention to the difference between them. The operation of this in depreciating the value of property depending upon past contracts and of all other property is apparent. Nor can it require argument to prove that a nation ought not to suffer the value of the property of its citizens to fluctuate with the fluctuations of a foreign mint, or to change with the changes in the regulations of a foreign sovereign. The quantity of gold and silver in the national coins, corresponding with a given sum, cannot be made less than heretofore without disturbing the balance of intrinsic value and making every acre of land, as well as every bushel of wheat, of less actual worth than in time past. This could not fail to distract the ideas of the community, and would be apt to breed discontent as well among those who live on the income of their money as among the poorer classes of the people to whom the necessities of life would become dearer." Bimetallism. Note in the preceding quotation that Hamilton referred to both gold and silver coins, not merely silver. That is because it was precisely at this time that Congress began to consider a bimetallic coinage. In retrospect, this was a mistake, for throughout history, bimetallism has never worked well very long. It always has led to confusion and, ultimately, the disappearance as money of one of the metals. This is because there is always a subtle shifting of the relative values between gold and silver, or any other two metals for that matter, depending on constantly changing supply and demand. We may set a value ratio of one to the other that is quite acceptable today, but eventually that ratio will no longer reflect reality. The metal which grows in value over the other will be hoarded, or possibly even melted down because it will bring a higher price as metal than it will as money. That is precisely what happened in the early days of our republic. It was determined after careful analysis of the free market that the value of gold at that time was approximately 15 times the value of silver. The Coinage Act of 1792 accordingly set the relative value of gold to silver at 15 to 1. It then authorized the federal government to mint gold coins called eagles, and it specified that their value was $10. In other words, the gold coins would be equal in value to 10 silver coins. 10 silver coins, each of 371.25 grains of fine silver, would contain a total of 3,712.5 grains. The content of the eagle, therefore, was 1/15 that amount, or 247.5 grains of fine gold. Contrary to popular misconception, Congress did not create a gold dollar. It didn't do that until 57 years later in the Coinage Act of 1849. In fact, it reaffirmed that the money of account of the United States shall be expressed in dollars or units, and again defined those units as coins containing 371.25 grains of pure silver. What Congress did do was authorize the minting of a gold coin and arbitrarily fix the value of the gold in that coin at 15 times the value of the dollar. and it also stated that all silver and gold coins produced in the federal mint were to be legal tender in accordance with their value based on weight and purity relative to the standard of the silver dollar. Oh yes, another thing. It set the death penalty for anyone who debases the nation's coinage, a law which, if enforced today, would wipe out the House of Representatives, the Senate, the managerial level of the Treasury Department, and the presidency as well. Free coinage. Perhaps the most important provision of this act, however, was the establishment of what is called free coinage. Under free coinage, any citizen may take raw silver or gold to the mint and, for a nominal fee, have it converted into coins for personal use. The government merely performs a technical function of creating the coin and stamping it with its insignia to certify the correct weight and purity. The state's role in this is exactly the same as inspecting the scales in a grocery store or the meter on a gasoline pump. It is merely fulfilling the constitutional requirement to set standards and verify the accuracy of weights and measures. Free coinage was to become an important part of the American success story, and it lasted until the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, which not only terminated it, but even made it illegal for citizens to possess gold. We shall take a closer look at that dismal period in a later section, but for now it is important to recall the greatness of our monetary system as it once was. Elgin Groseclose explains, "The principle of free coinage has proved its practical worth as a deterrent to debasement and depreciation. Where coinage is on private account, there is no profit to the state in tampering with the standard, and there is no opportunity for such practice by the individual. The circulation of coins of similar appearance and denomination, but of uncertain standard, the arbitrary and unpredictable modifications in the standard by autocratic government, the temptations to profit which were constantly dangled before despotic rulers, these were evils which had perplexed and harassed society and hindered the natural growth of economy since the days when coined money first appeared. By a stroke, they were swept away. At the same time, the institution of free coinage, by giving stability and character to one of the chief instruments of organized economy, made possible a more vigorous and healthy commercial life, and gave prestige and increased substance to the government adopting it." Sound money and economic prosperity. This was indeed an auspicious beginning for the new nation, and the result was immediately observable in an upsurge in prosperity. The December 16, 1789 edition of the Pennsylvania Gazette declared, "Since the federal constitution has removed all danger of our having a paper tender, our trade is advanced 50%. But that was just the beginning. Historian Douglas North says that the years 1793 to 1808 were years of unparalleled prosperity. Lewis Hacker describes the period as one of unexampled business expansion, one of the greatest, in fact, the United States has had. The exports of the country mounted from 19 millions in 1791 to 93 millions in 1801. Furthermore, the federal deficit, which amounted to 28% of expenditures in 1792, dropped to 21% in 1795. By 1802, the deficit had disappeared altogether and had been replaced by a surplus that was almost as large as the government's total spending." George Washington watched this economic miracle with great satisfaction, and in correspondence to his friend Lafayette, the French statesman and former general in the Continental Army, Washington commented, "Our country, my dear sir, is fast progressing in its political importance and social happiness." In a letter to Catherine Macaulay Graham, he said, "The United States enjoys a sense of prosperity and tranquility under the new government that could hardly have been hoped for." And in a letter to the American poet and diplomat David Humphreys, Washington exclaimed, "Our public credit stands on that high ground which 3 years ago it would have been considered as a species of madness to have foretold. On the specific subject of paper money without backing by gold or silver, Washington wrote, "We may one day become a great commercial and flourishing nation, but if in the pursuit of the means we should unfortunately stumble again on unfunded paper money or any similar species of fraud, we shall assuredly give a fatal stab to our national credit in its infancy." This, then, was the monetary blueprint laid down by the men who drafted our Constitution. In retrospect, about the only flaw one can find was the attempt to set a fixed ratio between the value of gold and silver. Rather than placing a dollar value on a gold coin, the mint should have imprinted the gold value in terms of weight and fineness. The free market then would have assigned it an exchange value in terms of goods and services, and that automatically would have determined its correct monetary value as a ratio to the silver dollars which were bidding for the purpose of the same items. It was inevitable, therefore, that soon after the $10 eagle was created, the value of gold over silver began to climb higher than the prescribed ratio of 15-1, and the eagles ceased to circulate. In later years, with the discovery of the great gold fields in California and Australia, the process reversed itself, and silver dollars disappeared from commerce. But even though this bimetallism led to a discrepancy between the actual conversion ratio and that which the government had prescribed, nevertheless it took place in the open market, and no one was greatly injured by the inconvenience. Throughout it all, there was just one standard, the defined silver content of a dollar. Furthermore, both the silver and gold coins were of intrinsic value and totally honest in their measure. No nation could do more for the prosperity of its citizens than that. Summary. The Constitution prohibits both the states and the federal government from issuing fiat money. This was the deliberate intent of the Founding Fathers, who had bitter experience with fiat money before and especially during the Revolutionary War. In response to the need to have a precisely defined national monetary unit, Congress adopted the Spanish dollar, then currently in use, and defined the content of that dollar to be 371.25 grains of pure silver. With the establishment of a federal mint, American silver dollars were issued in accordance with that standard, and gold eagles also were produced, which were then equal in value to 10 silver dollars. Most importantly, free coinage was established, wherein Americans were able to convert their raw silver and gold into national coins officially certified by the government as to their intrinsic value. The product of these measures was a period of sound money and great economic prosperity, a period that would come to an end only when the next generation of Americans forgot to read their history and returned to the use of paper money and bills of credit. The monetary plan laid down by the Founding Fathers was the product of collective genius. Nowhere in history can one find so many men in one legislative body who understood the fraud inherent in fiat money and the hidden taxation nature of inflation. There was never such an assembly of scholars and statesmen determined to set a safe course for the nation of their own creation. Literally, they handed us a treasure map. All we had to do was follow it to economic security and national prosperity. But as we shall see in the following sections, that map was discarded when the lessons of history died out with those who had lived it. Chapter 16. The Creature Comes to America. The story of the Bank of North America, the nation's first central bank, which was formed even before the Constitution was drafted. The story of the First Bank of the United States, the nation's second central bank, which was formed in 1791. The massive inflation caused by both banks. The causes of their demise. It is a surprising fact that the United States had its first central bank even before the Constitution was drafted. It was chartered by the Continental Congress in the spring of 1781 and opened its doors the following year. There were great expectations at that time that the province of Canada would soon join the rebel colonies to form a union extending across the entire North American continent. In anticipation of that, the new financial institution was called the Bank of North America. The bank was organized by Robert Morris, a member of Congress, who was a leader of a group of politicians and merchants who wanted the new nation to imitate the mercantilism of England. They wanted high taxes to support a powerful centralized government, high tariffs to subsidize domestic industry, a large army and navy, and the acquisition of colonial outposts to expand into foreign lands and markets. He was a wealthy Philadelphia merchant who had profited greatly from war contracts during the Revolution. He had carefully studied the secret science of money, and by 1781 was widely considered to be the financial wizard of Congress. The Bank of North America was modeled closely after the Bank of England. Following the practice of fractional reserve, it was allowed to issue paper promissory notes in excess of actual deposits, but since some gold and silver had to be held in the vault, there were definite limits to how far that process could go. Banknotes were not forced on the people as legal tender for all debts, public and private, but the government did agree to accept them at their face value in payment of all taxes and duties, which made them as good as gold for that specific purpose. Furthermore, unlike the central banks of today, the Bank of North America was not given the power to directly issue the nation's money. Functioned as a central bank. On the other hand, the bank was given the right of monopoly in its field, which means there were no other banknotes allowed to circulate in competition. This, plus the fact that they were accepted at face value in payment of all federal and state taxes, plus the further fact that the federal government did not at that time have a functioning money of its own, made these banknotes attractive for use as a circulating medium of exchange. The intended result was that the bank's paper would be accepted as money, which for a while it was. Furthermore, the bank was made the official depository for all federal funds, and it almost immediately lent $1.2 million to the government, much of which was created out of nothing for that purpose. So, in spite of the limitations placed upon the bank, and in spite of the fact that it was essentially a private institution, it was intended to be, and in fact did, function as a central bank. The Bank of North America was fraudulent from the very start. The charter required that private investors provide $400,000 for the initial subscription. When Morris was unable to raise that money, he used his political influence to make up the shortfall out of government funds. In a maneuver that was nothing less than legalized embezzlement, he took the gold that had been lent to the United States from France and had it deposited in the bank. Then, using this as a fractional reserve base, he simply created the money that was needed for the subscription and lent it to himself and his associates. Such is the power of the secret science. It is hard to reconcile the fact that the same men who adopted the brilliant monetary restraints of the Constitution a few years later would have allowed the Bank of North America to exist. It must be remembered, however, that the war was still in progress when the charter was issued, and even the wisest of statesmen are often obliged to follow expediency in such times. One also must conclude that, while the Founding Fathers were wise on the nature of fiat money created by the government's printing press, they had not yet had extensive experience with the same mechanism hidden behind the obscurities of fractional reserve banking. In any event, the bank was not to have its charter renewed by Congress, and it did not survive beyond the end of the war. Murray Rothbard details its demise. Despite the monopoly privileges conferred upon the Bank of North America and its nominal redeemability in specie, the market's lack of confidence in the inflated notes led to their depreciation outside the bank's home base in Philadelphia. The bank even tried to bolster the value of its notes by hiring people to urge redeemers of its notes not to insist on specie, a move scarcely calculated to improve the long-run confidence in the bank. After a year of operation, Morris's political power slipped, and he moved quickly to shift the Bank of North America from a central bank to a purely commercial bank chartered by the state of Pennsylvania. By the end of 1783, the first experiment with a central bank in the United States had ended. A fitting epilogue to this story was written 200 years later when, in 1980, the first Pennsylvania Bank of Philadelphia, the oldest bank in the nation, was bailed out by the FDIC. An end run around the Constitution. It will be recalled that after the Bank of North America was terminated, and after the Constitutional Convention closed the door on paper money, the United States enjoyed a period of unparalleled economic growth and prosperity. But while the door may have been closed, the window was still open. Congress was denied the power to print money, but it was not denied the power to borrow it. In the vocabulary of the common man, to borrow is to accept a loan of something that already exists. He is confused, therefore, when the banker issues money out of nothing and then says he is lending it. He appears to be lending, but in reality, he is creating. Then, as now, the mysteries of banking vocabulary were not revealed to the average man, and it was difficult to understand how privately issued banknotes could serve precisely the same purpose as printing press money, with precisely the same disastrous results. That being the case, the monetary and political scientists decided to end-run the Constitution. Their plan was to establish a bank, to give that bank the power to create money, to lend most of that money to the government, and then to make sure the IOUs are accepted as money by the public. Congress, therefore, would not be emitting bills of credit. The bank would do that. Thus, the first bank of the United States was conceived. The proposal was submitted to Congress in 1790 by Alexander Hamilton, who, at that time, was Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton, incidentally, was a former aide to Robert Morris, founder of the Bank of North America, so that in that sense his role in this matter is not surprising. What is surprising is the fact that Hamilton had been a staunch supporter of a sound currency during the Constitutional Convention. This is hard to reconcile, and one must suspect that even the most well-intentioned of men can become corrupted by the temptations of wealth and power. It is possible that Hamilton, Morris, and other Federalist leaders had hoped to keep the government out of the money-making business, not because it was the constitutional thing to do, but because that would leave the field clear for a central bank mechanism, which, because it was further from public view and political control, could become their own private engine of profit. It would appear that the only other explanation is that these men were fickle in their views and did not really understand the implications of their acts. In view of their brilliance in all other matters, however, it is difficult to muster enthusiasm for that interpretation. The Hamilton-Jefferson Conflict. Hamilton's proposal was strongly opposed by Thomas Jefferson, then Secretary of State, and this was the beginning of a heated political debate that would preoccupy Congress for many decades to come. In fact, it was one of the central issues that led to the creation of our first political parties. The Federalists gathered around the ideas of Hamilton. The Anti-Federalists, later called the Republicans, were attracted to the ideas of Jefferson. Jefferson pointed out that the Constitution did not grant to Congress the power to create a bank or anything similar. That means such power is reserved to the states or to the people. In a rebuttal to Hamilton's proposal, he said, "To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition." Furthermore, he said, even if the Constitution had granted such power, it would be an extremely unwise thing to do, because allowing banks to create money could only lead to national ruin. Hamilton, on the other hand, argued that debt was a good thing, if kept within reason, and that the nation needed more money in circulation to keep up with expanding commerce. Only the bank, he said, would be able to provide that. Furthermore, while it is true the Constitution did not specifically grant the power to create such a bank, it was, nevertheless, an implied power because it was needed to accomplish other functions which were granted in the Constitution. That was the end run. Nothing could be more polarized than the opposing ideas of these two men. Jefferson: a private central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army. We must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt. Hamilton: no society could succeed which did not unite the interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state. A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. America's second central bank is created. After a year of intense debate, Hamilton's views prevailed, and in 1791 Congress granted a 20-year charter to the Bank of the United States. It was modeled closely after the Bank of England, which means it was almost an exact replica of the previous Bank of North America. In fact, as evidence of continuity with the past, the president of the new bank was Thomas Willing, the same man who had been a partner of Robert Morris and president of the old bank. As before, the new bank was given a monopoly in the issuance of banknotes. Once again, these notes were not forced on the people as legal tender for private debts and contracts, but they were legal tender at face value for all debts to the government in the form of taxes and duties, which made them attractive for use as common money. And once again, the bank was made the official depository of all federal funds. The charter specified that the bank was required at all times to redeem its notes in gold or silver specie upon demand by the depositor. That was an admirable provision, but since the bank was not also required to keep specie in its vaults in the full amount of its note obligations, it was a mathematical impossibility to uphold. As with the old Bank of North America, the new Bank of the United States was to have 80% of its capital provided by private investors, with the federal government putting up only 20%. That was a mere bookkeeping sleight of hand, however, because it had been prearranged for the bank to immediately lend back to the federal government exactly that same amount. Reminiscent of the Morris scheme in capitalizing the Bank of North America, this federal investment was essentially a means whereby federal funds could be used to make up the shortfall of the private investors. "Call it by what name you please," said Jefferson. "This was not a loan or an investment, but an outright gift." And he was certainly right. The bank was able to open its doors with less than 9% of the private capital required by its charter. The total capitalization was specified at $10 million, which means that $8 million was to come from private stockholders. However, as John Kenneth Galbraith wryly observed, numerous thrifty participants confined themselves to a modest down payment, and the bank began operations on around $675,000 in hard cash. The creature comes from Europe. Who were these private investors? Their names do not appear in the published literature, but we can be certain they included the congressmen and senators, and their associates, who engineered the charter. But there is an interesting line in Galbraith's text that hints at another dimension to the composition of this group. On page 72 of Money, Whence It Came, Where It Went, he states matter-of-factly, "Foreigners could own shares, but not vote them." What a story is hidden behind that innocuous statement. The blunt reality is that the Rothschild banking dynasty in Europe was the dominant force, both financially and politically, in the formation of the Bank of the United States. Biographer Derek Wilson explains, "Over the years since N.M. Rothschild, The Manchester textile manufacturer had bought cotton from the southern states. Rothschilds had developed heavy American commitments. Nathan had made loans to various states of the Union, had been for a time the official European banker for the U.S. government, and was a pledged supporter of the Bank of the United States. Gustavus Myers, in his History of the Great American Fortunes, is more pointed. He says, "Under the surface, the Rothschilds long had a powerful influence in dictating American financial laws. The law records show that they were the power in the old Bank of the United States. The Rothschilds, therefore, were not merely investors, nor just an important power. They were the power behind the Bank of the United States. The significance of the Rothschild power in American finance and politics was the subject of extensive comment in a previous section, so there is no need to cover that ground again. It is important here, however, to at least make a mental note of the fact that the creature from Jekyll Island is descended from a species that is not native to this land." Inflation all over again. From the beginning, the primary purpose of the bank was to create money for the federal government. Money for the private sector was strictly secondary. That was made clear by the fact that the maximum rate of interest it was allowed to charge was 6%. That made it impractical to make loans to anyone except the federal government and a few large prime-rate borrowers, and the government wasted no time putting its new central bank mechanism to work. Having invested $2 million at the start, it converted that into $8.2 million borrowed within the next 5 years, which means that $6.2 million was created specifically for its use. Anyone familiar with the history of money as outlined in the previous section could easily write the following paragraph. "The creation of millions of new fractional reserve dollars, which the government pushed into the economy through spending programs, caused an imbalance between the supply of money and the supply of goods and services. Prices appeared to go up as the relative value of the dollar went down. In that same 5-year period, wholesale prices rose by 72%, which is another way of saying that 42% of everything people had saved in the form of money was quietly confiscated by the government through the hidden tax called inflation. The same inflation effect that previously had plagued the colonies now returned to plague the new generation. This time, instead of being caused by printing press money, it was fractional reserve money. The cog that linked the two mechanisms together and caused them to function as one was federal debt. It was federal debt that allowed the political and monetary scientists to violate the intent of the founding fathers, and it was this same federal debt that prompted Jefferson to exclaim, 'I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the general principle of the Constitution. I mean an additional article taking from the federal government their power of borrowing.'" Like so many things in the real world, the Bank of the United States was a mixture of evil with some good. It certainly was not all bad. In colonial times, the state governments printed as much paper money as they pleased, and the loss of purchasing power was, in many cases, total. The bank, on the other hand, was required to maintain some gold and specie as a base for its pyramid of money, even though it was an inverted pyramid, with reserves being smaller than the quantity of banknotes. It still represented a boundary to just how far the money supply could be expanded, and that was good. Furthermore, it is apparent that the bank's directors were imbued with a certain amount of enlightened self-interest, in that they actually wanted to keep the creation of new money within some kind of control. They could profit from the central bank mechanism only so long as the economy as a whole was productive enough to support it. They did not want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So, like their counterparts in the Federal Reserve System of our modern day, they spoke the language of restraint, and in a few instances, even acted with restraint as well. Wildcat Banks. For example, it was during this period that wildcat banks began to flourish. They were given that name not because they were untamed, although that would have been another good reason to do so, but because they were located in areas so remote